The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us here on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. First, though, given the week that's in it, we're actually going to do something a little bit different than the usual news round, because the biggest story from the science world this week in Ireland had nothing to do with research. Last Saturday, an interview with Dr. Evie Hullivan, a broadcaster and lecturer in UCD and full disclosure colleague of mine, was featured in the Irish Times. And in it, Dr. Hullivan outlined the extent to which she was repeatedly harassed by a professor at UCD over the course of 2 years. The experience came to a head in 2019 when the man, Professor Hans Benjamin Brown, was finally charged for harassment in the courts. The reason we want to talk about this today is because we often talk in this country about how we want more girls and women in science. And yet, and maybe even because of that, we rarely acknowledge that part of the reason for this imbalance of gender may be that a career in research at a university is not always a welcoming or safe place. We have a platform on this program, and we felt we wanted to use that platform to discuss harassment at a wider level and also what it's like being a woman in science today, and what should be done in particular to protect women from sexual or regular harassment in the future. To discuss this, I'm joined by Dr. Emma Chapman. She's a physicist at Imperial College London and director of the 1752 Group, a research organisation that deals with sexual misconduct, particularly in higher education. And Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, who's a lecturer in physics in NUI Galway. She studied also in Trinity College Dublin, and she's involved in Soapbox Science, an outreach programme promoting women in research, and she's a regular contributor to this program. Emma and Jessamine, you're both very welcome. Emma, maybe we might start off with your reaction to reading this story and how you reflected upon it, having been a victim of harassment yourself in the past.
It's an interesting question, because it would have depended on when you'd asked me in the last week. It's been an evolving reaction, I must admit. When I first read it, I was fairly numb to it, because I've read a lot of these stories before. As co-director of the 1752 Group, you know, we've spent 5 years reading these stories all over the world, and without detracting from the seriousness or the shock factor of them, they are all just as shocking as each other in a way. At the time, I thought, okay, well, this is you know, it's shocking but normal, almost. And actually, as the week has gone on, I have got angrier and less numb to this particular story as I've read it and reread it. And I think it's because it has all the elements of a classic sexual misconduct in academia tale, with the, I would say, inadequate support of the institution. And this is not even going into the actual harassment itself, which is, of course, just utterly disgraceful. But in terms of the institutional response, it's got all of these kind of like prolonged elements, the re-traumatizing almost of the victim. But it's the time frame that annoys me. So this is still happening. and it's got to the point now. How many stories do we need to hear? What's the right number for institutions and governments to sit up and say, This has gone on long enough. What we need is, you know, we need universities to take a stand on this. And I was very pleased, actually, in this case. That's why now I'm kind of mellowing out a bit at the end of the week, to see that I believe it's the Minister of Higher Education, Simon Harris, did present quite a strong reaction to this case and what looks like a solid plan for the first steps to tackle this within Ireland. So I really hope that does play out.
What goes through the mind of someone over the course of those 2 years, Emma? I know we probably don't want to go into details too much. I don't want to re-traumatize you, but what sort of effect does being harassed have on your ability to work and research and contribute to what is a very competitive environment?
I think it's one in a long line of hurdles that women have to face. in academia and in science in particular. The harassment that I experienced was of what I struggled to call low level for several years, in that it was I learned to live with it. And then, unfortunately, towards the end of my time as a PhD student, I experienced a series of much more profoundly distressing incidents, which were life altering. They still affect me to this day. Unfortunately, it resulted in me getting post-traumatic stress disorder, which I struggle with still today. So, you know, even reading this kind of story, I was numb at the start of it, and I thought, okay. And actually, it's only a few days later that it really hits you in your core, that in so many ways you want what happened to you to have meant something. And, you know, I spoke out at great personal cost to try and stop this happening again. And reading Dr. Ní Húlavaughn's words in the Irish Times, they could have been mine from 5 years ago, to say, I just want to make sure this doesn't happen to someone again. And it breaks my heart that I am still seeing women putting their most awful experiences out there to just prevent it happening again. And I want to start hearing the words from the university chancellors and presidents. I want to hear them on the record saying what went wrong, not just, oh, sorry, we're going to be zero tolerance from now on. In terms of what the effect of it can be, as co-director of the 1752 group, we have done research into the long-term effects of it. And what we find is that people that experience harassment are much more likely to change their university options. They're much more likely to change their careers. They can experience severe mental health problems for many years going forward. And in academia, we are in a niche environment. So if you get harassed by your supervisor, for example, or someone with an effect on your career like I did, then that can have profound consequences for your career in the form of not being able to find a reference. And just one more thing, like, research came out this week, which from Stockholm University, I believe, that showed that victims of prolonged sexual harassment were 3 times more likely to die by suicide, and twice as likely to have suicidal ideations.
No, it is absolutely horrific to have to go through it. And of course, and we'll talk about this in a bit, it can be a lonely road to have to walk. But I want to ask you how common you think this is, because I'm sure there are people listening who are thinking, yes, but this isn't academia in general. This was a once-off case, and it probably hardly ever happens like this. Yes, this is an extreme case. Yes, this features someone who already is in the public eye and has, you know, the fortune to have the strength to be able to come out and speak about her experiences, despite the costs. But from what, as you called, a lower level up, this is possibly and probably very likely much more common than we think.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think 5 years ago, universities might have been able to use the excuse that this might be, you know, I hate this phrase, but the bad eggs of academia. And that is the danger of these individual stories coming out when we don't zoom out to have this broader focus. Now there has been so many of these, what they would term anecdotal stories, that you've got to look at the statistics here. But more than that, there has been research done on this, and it doesn't take long to look at this. You know, the American Association of Universities did a study and found that I believe it was about 1 in 7, I think it was, postgraduates experienced it. The Australian Human Rights Commission got involved in this, and that was around 7% of undergraduate women that experienced sexual harassment.
Which is a lot.
Yes, it's a huge number. So, you know, we are talking vast numbers of women experiencing this. In terms of staff sexual misconduct, that's much harder to quantify. It's a much more hidden problem. Unfortunately, within the UK, we haven't had the funding to do a prevalence study on this, but we have canvassed around 1,800 students and did find significant numbers. Again, it's not a prevalence study, so I'm not comfortable saying the numbers, but it is a lot, and it is more than enough to take action, and that is the important point for me.
Jessamine, we've talked about harassment, before we've gone on to talk about other things on the program, and it's a subject that it's a tricky one to talk about at times. And I wanted to get your thoughts. Do we not talk about harassment because we're trying to encourage women and girls to do science in Ireland? Is that a part of it? Or why is this not discussed more openly, do you think, in Ireland? You've studied in Trinity College and NUI Galway. What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, well, I definitely think that's part of it, right? I know both Emma and I are in physics, which has a terrible proportion or representation of women compared to the broader population. And you get asked to do all these things to like get more girls into physics, get more girls into STEM. And we do have to ask ourselves, like, what's happening to them once they get there? I mean, I want women in science more than anybody, but I also want them to be treated fairly and respectfully. And, you know, I want them to have not just the same career opportunities, but also to be given the same resources and level of investment as their male colleagues. I do think, too, that in the sciences, there can be this temptation to think, oh, well, you know, the science is one thing and it's objective and it stands on its own and all these like mushy people things. Well, that's something else entirely. And to kind of say, well, if the science is strong, it'll do well. And if it's not, then, you know, it won't. But to think that that's totally divorced from the people that do science and the prejudices that they might or might not have. And, you know, if you want to read more about this, the best source, in my opinion, is, of course, Angela Saini's two books, Inferior and Superior, where she talks about both gender in Inferior and also race in Superior, and how the prejudices of scientists in the past actually directly informed the scientific results, I'm using air quotes, radio listeners, that they found. And, you know, like, I believe in the scientific process. I would have hoped that that wasn't true, but no, it turns out science is done by people. People bring those prejudices in. And so there's this kind of temptation to think, oh, sexual harassment, that's a separate issue from the science, but it directly impacts who gets to do science, who gets to create that knowledge, and then, of course, what it looks like.
So one of the things that I suppose is most shocking about Dr. Nihulawan's case is the lack of support that she got from the university in question, UCD, and they have themselves acknowledged the failure of some of their policies to support her. What do we need in the future to be able to allow young women who are starting their career in science or anyone who's experiencing harassment, sexual or otherwise, to be able to speak, get resolution quickly and remove themselves from that environment so they can continue to work in science and feel comfortable and feel safe?
I think we need policies which present both the complainants or witnesses and the accused on an equal footing. Currently, most policies in the UK certainly don't do that, and I can't speak directly to Irish policy, but I can speak internationally. We find that these policies in Australia, in Nigeria, in India, in South America, they all give far more rights to the accused person. So, for example, they will have the right to appeal, they'll have the right to legal counsel, they'll have the right to bring witnesses. All of this is not found when you're a complainant. And so, again, in my own case, it's very typical. I had to submit what are the equivalent of freedom of information requests just to find out a more full picture of the outcome of the process.
And I think that does happen here in Ireland, where complainants don't, the complaint is made and then after that, there is a sort of vacuum of information where they're wondering what's happened. And because of, I suppose, a deference to the reputation of the accused, information doesn't flow, people don't know what's going on, and that can make it only more distressing for the person who's been harassed.
Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine already going through years of terror, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that, and then making that decision to come forward, and you go through that horrible moment. Well, you go through that wonderful moment, actually, of thinking, gosh, I've been believed, and they're going to do something, and there's going to be justice, and it will have meant something. And then you suddenly realize when nobody's returning your emails and it's been a year that actually it's all been brushed under the carpet and you have just, you've just thrown all your chips in and it's come to nothing. And, and it's come to worse than that, because actually the perpetrator has been told everything you've said. And so now they are guns blazing for you in terms of your career. And I mean, it's hugely upsetting. It's been 5 years for me actually. And since I even made the complaint, I moved to Australia for 3 months because I was so scared at one point when I was making this complaint, and I still have to deal with this, you know, day to day in terms of retaliation.
What do we need to do, Emma? Yes, what is the best practice? Do we need to have an independent a body that can take out that power play that we see in universities or see in these places and investigate it fairly from both sides?
Yes, I think we do. I think we need to start looking at an independent body or a regulatory body. I wouldn't have said that a few years ago, but I think universities have had their chance. They've shown that they can't do this by themselves. They are far too legally caught up in everything that they've done in the past to actually look to the future. I think we need to see fair policies and regulation of policies across sectors, so that universities are all on a fair standing point, and we don't get into this situation where we're passing the perpetrator, which does happen quite a lot. We need to see funding. So many of these initiatives around the world, are all of the policy change that we have driven in the UK has been done purely on our spare time.
I think a lot of people are going to be watching this issue. It's interesting to see comments from Nolene Blackwell, comments from Simon Harris, and it'd be interesting to see what change we will see, not just in UCD, but across Irish universities in response to this story. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield and Dr. Emma Chapman, thank you very much for joining us.